In 1968, Deborah Harry made her mark as a backup vocalist for The Wind in the Willows, forming Blondie a few years later in 1974. Joan Jett was a founding member of groundbreaking band The Runaways back in 1975, while that same year Pat Benatar hit the scene at New York's Catch a Rising Star, just a few years before her debut solo album in 1979. All of these legendary women of rock have cited one pioneer as their greatest influence, and that is the iconic Susie Quattro, who began her career in 1964 as part of the Pleasure Seekers. Her first solo hit was Can the Can. Rock legend Susie Quattro is undoubtedly a musical pioneer. Having established herself as a star during the 1970s glam rock era, Susie has had a remarkable run of British hits from that decade, among them Can the Can, Devil Gate Drive, 48 Crash, The Wild One, and If You Can't Give Me Love. At a time where there were few female musicians in the hard rock genre, Susie broke the mold for every woman in rock and roll. She also had a role on the iconic TV series Happy Days as Leather Tuscadero. If there was ever an occasion for American music fans to rediscover Susie, there's a documentary out there titled Susie Q, which provides that perfect opportunity. It's available on video on demand and DVD, and it traces Susie's professional triumphs and her personal obstacles. It is a testament to her legacy, as a number of musicians interviewed for the documentary, including Joan Jett, Lita Ford, Blondie's Deborah Harry, Clem Burke, and so many others. Her latest album is called The Devil in Me, and now from London is Susie Quattro. Susie, so thrilled that we have connected.
I know. And you're Midwest, same as me. Do you know that the Midwest accent is the nicest accent in America?
I think it's true. And you know what? We don't even know we have one here. You know?
No, I know. There you go. I'm always telling people in England, oh, I can't understand your accent. I'm going, wait a minute, I have one.
And that's amazing to think that, because I think we all think we're the ones speaking clearly and normally, and it's everybody else that has the accent,
sure.
Right?
Of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course.
I got to see this documentary, and I have to tell you, you have had and continue to lead a pretty damn cool life.
Yeah, it's been an amazing ride. You know, I started at 14 in the band and picked up the bass guitar, became the lead singer, became the main person. And, you know, that was 1964, so I've been playing ever since. It's now 2021. And with the same love, energy, honesty, and the same need, I always have the fire in my belly that has never left me.
You know, Joan Jett, Pat Benatar, Debbie Harry all say you were a big influence on them. And it's been said that in your journey, you kind of gave women permission to be rock and rollers. And that's quite a statement.
That is quite a statement. And, you know, I have to be honest, though. I'm always very honest. I knew from a very young age, I'll give you a potted history, I didn't fit anywhere. I know there's other people out there like me. I just couldn't find my niche when I was growing up. Got into the band, I found my niche in music, but couldn't quite find my niche of what it was I wanted to do in music. And then I had my first hit, and then everything made sense. So when you can't fit anywhere, you have no choice but to find your own place. So what you do end up doing without meaning to is you create something brand new, which is what I did. And I didn't have an agenda. I didn't know I was doing it. I kicked down the door because, to be honest, I didn't see the door. But for some reason, I strapped it on, and I just went, yep, here I am, I'm home.
All right, well, we just got started with our radio special, The Women of Rock, and there's more with music icon Susie Quattro right here on 720 WGN. All right, it's our Women of Rock radio special, and we're talking to music icon Susie Quattro. You know, this documentary that came out a few years ago, telling your story on screen, must have been better than therapy on some level, right?
You will love this. Cherie Curry, she's now a good friend of mine. I went to my first premiere of the documentary in London at the Regent Theatre, and I was due to go up on stage, you know, do a little question and answer, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to see the documentary with an audience, because that's how you see something.
That's right, absolutely.
You feel, you know, where the laughs are, where the moans are, where the tears are, da, da, da. So I'm watching it. And I am in tears myself. Oh. All these women coming out, one after the other. I'm going, oh, my God, I'm in tears. And I called Cherie the next night, and I said, I have something to tell you. And she said, what? And I said, well, I just realized that by doing what I did, I gave permission to women all over the world to be different. And she went silent. And then she said, and you just got that?
Yeah, that's funny. Wow.
It was the way she waited, and you just got that. Yes, but it's refreshing, isn't it, that I didn't have an agenda.
Well, it's funny you say you broke down the door, but he also said the truth is you broke down the door because you didn't see the door. You know, you were just being you.
I didn't get it. I just didn't. Yeah. I don't do gender, first of all. That's said in the documentary, too. I don't really do gender. Never have. I've never considered myself never a female musician. I've never called myself that. Mm-hmm. I just say I'm a musician.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's
sure.
The done and dusted, you know. And I'm not the kind of think I can't do something because I'm female. That wouldn't even cross my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll go up to a guy 6'2" and tell him off. Even thinking for a second I'm in any danger.
I know that. All 5'2" of you. I know.
You're
I know.
5'2" of me before I make it count, I tell you.
That's right.
Don't mess with me.
That's right. I love that. I always wonder, you know, like where the musical influences began in your life. Your father had a jazz band, the Art Quattro Trio, right?
He did. And I first played bongo drums. At the age of 7, going on 8, and when I got quite good on them, and he used to let me come along to his gigs sometimes and play, sit on a little stool in front of the trio and play the bongo. So that was cool. That was cool.
Yeah.
And then I went to classical piano, then I went to percussion, and then at 14 I picked up the bass.
Yeah, by yourself. I was going to say, your dad gave you a 57 Fender Precision, and that's top of the line. You got that guitar? Is that what really kind of set the tone for you of what you wanted to do?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And, you know, it's so funny because all I did was say to my dad, who's a musician, we had all the instruments in the house. Yeah. We had accordion, 2 or 3 pianos, an organ. We had guitars. We had mandolins, banjos, you know, everything. And we even had a harp, full-size harp. And I said to my dad, we're starting a band. I'm going to play bass. Do you have one? He said, sure, I got one you can use. And he gave me a 1957 Fender Precision. I didn't know that it was a Rolls-Royce of bass guitars. Yeah. I didn't know that there might have been smaller necks and smaller basses. All I know was my dad gave me that bass, and that's what I had to learn.
And in this documentary, too, you talk about your strong family structure, and your parents were pretty strict with you. How did that help you along the way, having that strict upbringing?
Oh, God, I forever thank my mother for that. She was quite Catholic, and she, you know, she gave me the tracks to run down for the rest of my life. If I go, all of us, you know, go off the road a little bit, you know, everybody does, but I never can go far off the road because her teachings are too strong in me, and I thank her for that because the old sex, drugs, and rock and roll didn't appeal to me whatsoever, and I'm still out there doing it.
I love it. But then there you were, you know, okay, you got the guitar in like the late 50s. You were really, really young when you saw Elvis, which would have probably at that time, 6 years old, but had been on the Steve Allen Show or Milton Berle or stage show. He was a big influence.
It was on the Ed Sullivan Show.
It was Sullivan. Okay, so he would have been an influence for you, really, for your entire life.
Oh, I never forget it. It was probably my first light bulb moment in my life. And we were all, you know, everything stopped for the Ed Sullivan Show. Boom, done, 8 o'clock, family sits down, Ed Sullivan
Sunday
Show.
Nights, yeah.
And all of us were there, 5 kids. And at the end, he always brought on something for the youngsters, mm-hmm. as he used to like to say. And on comes Elvis doing Don't Be Cruel. Now, my eldest sister by 9 years, she starts screaming. Now, I'm only 5 and a half. I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking, why are you screaming? What's the matter with you? Then I turned and looked at the TV, and I always remember this, and I kind of went into it, like hypnotized almost into it. And a little light bulb moment, and I actually thought to myself, I'm going to do that.
Wow. Wow.
That age.
Yeah.
Amazing. And I don't know where that came from. It didn't even occur to me. I'm a little girl. He's a guy. I didn't even think about that. Just, I'm going to do that. And Elvis has been my spiritual advisor my entire career, I tell you.
I love that. And he really included your whole family in this. So here you are in the 1960s. You're a member of the, you know, you said he came from Detroit, you know, rock group The Pleasure Seekers, which became Cradle. It included sisters Patty, Arlene, and Nancy. What you wore was just as important as what you sang. Am I right?
Yes, sure. Sure. But yeah. How do you mean that?
Well, I mean, you know, for stage performances and stuff, it was critical, no matter what you were singing, you had to dress the part back then.
Oh, God. Okay. The club owners, because we did a lot of clubs, you know, that was good training, 5 shows a night, 45 on, 15 off. Boy, oh boy, you get your chops, I tell you. They wanted to have us look like girls because it was an all-girl band. So it right. wouldn't have been my choice of outfits, you know.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, they figured they got girls up there, they want you to look like that. So we had, like, little minis and, you know, little, I wore jumpsuits, bad thing. But yeah. all the pictures of me, even way back when, I have my top hat on. So my top hat was my rebellion.
I love that.
All right, I wear the mini skirt, but you got to take the top hat.
Yeah, yeah, you got to get this, too. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, a turning point, though, for you was, you know, Mickey Most, you know, Herman's Hermits, The Animals, saw you perform and offer you that solo contract. And as you say in the documentary, it caused obvious family issues because you were singing with your sisters, and you said that almost destroyed you personally.
Yeah, it was real hard. You know, that I have to be honest about it. And everybody in my position that I've talked to, people of the similar fame, I can't think of a different word. When you've got that little X factor thing, you know it from very young. You just know it. It's just something burning in you. You realize you can hold an audience. You realize you've got something that even when you're on the stage with other people, the eyes are on you. So you do know it. So I wasn't surprised when the two offers came in the same week. I had been waiting for it for a long time for it to be picked up. I'd been waiting. Not that I wanted to go, but I've been waiting for it to happen. Mm-hmm. Elektra Records saw Cradle, and they didn't want the band. They wanted me. They offered me a solo contract. The very same week, Mickey Most came, and he saw the band in Detroit. He was at Motown with Jeff Beck.
That's
saw
cool.
the band. Mm-hmm. Didn't want the band, only wanted me. So within 1 week, I had two offers.
Yeah, your life changed.
To go solo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Elektra wanted to make me into the next Janis Joplin. Mickey Most wanted to make me into the first Susie Quattro. So guess where I went?
We're talking to rock icon Susie Quattro, and there's more with her next on 720 WGN. You broke through so quickly with Can the Can in the early 70s, and it kicked off a wave of hits for you, especially in the UK. But I still don't understand this. Like, when I look back really at your career in the documentary, I don't understand why it was so hard to break through in the U.S., though.
No, nobody gets that. I think they did try to explore that in there. Even Mike Chapman said there was a little era there that they didn't get in America. I know when I started to tour there with my English band in 74, all I heard on the radio was the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I think, and Debbie Harry says it was a little bit early. They weren't quite, I mean, they loved me, they knew my albums, they knew who I was, I did lots of tours, but they weren't quite ready for the hit singles yet. And it took Happy Days, it took me playing that part,
yeah.
for them to see a girl playing bass guitar as a real contender.
I know. So Leather Tuscadero, and I have to say, you know, I was born in 67, so that was...
She broke Susie Quattro.
Yeah. I would say that's how I knew who you were from back then.
Isn't
I mean,
that funny?
Yeah. I know. I was 10, 11 years old, and I thought, wow, she's pretty cool, and she could really sing, and, you know, not even really understanding or knowing the background, but that's what made you... a little bit more of a household name in the U.S.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was a huge show.
Yeah.
Huge show. And a lot of people, it's the only place in the world, in America, where they say, oh, Leather Tuscadero. Everywhere else they say to me, weren't you on Happy Days?
That's hysterical.
It's a whole different thing. But anyway, it doesn't matter how you found me. You found me eventually.
That's right. It's absolutely true. I know, you know, again, watching the documentary, I know you've had your share of... Like, you know, you said you could handle yourself at all the 5'2". You had guys hitting on you, I'm sure, all the time, especially in the 70s and even the 60s. But you, of course, could take good care of yourself. But you let one person, and I love the story, get away with it. But you warned him that was the one chance he had and don't do it again. And that was Malcolm Young, right?
It was Angus Young.
Yeah.
Angus Young from AC/DC. I never forget it.
Yeah.
We were doing a TV show together in Germany, and I happened to be walking up the stairs in front of him, dangerous for a start. Okay?
Yeah, right.
Because I've got a very, very famous backside. I've even won Rear of the Year. So, and I've always had it. I've been told since I've been a little girl that I had a great. So there you go.
Gotcha.
Anyway, Angus Young pinched it. Okay,
yeah.
Pinched my.
Oh boy.
I turned to him with thunder. Thunder. He's lucky I didn't hit him immediately. He looked at me with his little baby face and he said, "I'm sorry."
Oh.
I know, and he went, I couldn't help myself. It actually was kind of cute. And that's when I said to him, okay, that was your one shot. He said, thank you.
Yeah, he got a pass on that. Yeah. I love that.
I'll give you a pass on that one.
I love
and then,
it.
You know, even in the documentary, you know, the host of the show smacks my ass. It was right after I won that Rear of the Year, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody asks me about that because I am not that kind of person. But what happened was I am a professional. That's the biggest word you can use about me. I'm professional, okay? Always have been. So we're on a live TV show, live.
Yeah.
And he took his moment to slap my ass. And as I'm turning around slowly, I'm thinking milliseconds all this slow process. Do I say something? Do I hit him? Do I do this? Do I do that? Wait a minute, you're on live. Let it go. So I sat down. And it could have backfired on me had I said anything. All this went through my head in milliseconds. It could have been like, oh, how precious is she? He's a little tap on the backside. Why? Oh, she's up herself. You know, this is what it could have done. So I let it go. I let it go. If he had done that backstage, and I've been famous for saying this, he would have been singing soprano for the rest of his life.
Because I could just look in your face and look in your eyes and know that I'd be a dead man. I'd be a dead man. I could just tell. I don't care how tall you are.
I mean, I might be 5'2", but I'm 6'4" in my brain, okay?
Yeah, I got it. I got it. What did some of these songs mean to you at that time? I mean, you knew these were big hits that were driving your popularity.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, the good thing was we had the arrangement that I wrote all the album with my ex, and Mike and Nikki would see what we've prepared for each album and then write the 3-minute commercial thing. That worked for a long time. It was fantastic. It was just fantastic. I was out there living the dream, doing what I always wanted to do, reaching millions and millions of people, selling millions of records, selling sold-out crowds, you know, living the dream. That's what I always wanted to do. So I'm still doing it now.
You are.
What's his name? Henry Winkler says in the documentary, and she's still doing it now. I love what he says at the end. Oh,
yeah.
What a sweetheart.
He's a sweet man. He's a very sweet man.
I love him.
You know, you also starred in the British musical production of Annie, Get Your Gun. You co-wrote and acted in theatrical work about actress Tallulah Bankhead. You also appeared on...
That was fantastic.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that and being on stage. Like, I mean, obviously you love performing on stage, but this is a whole different world, you know, being in theater.
Yeah, I really love it. I love the discipline of the theater. The first one I did was Annie, Get Your Gun. So there I was, never done a musical before, and walking in Ethel Merman's shoes. How fantastic is that?
Yeah, wow.
And because I'm a schooled pianist and all that, I decided I wanted to write one, and I did, about Tallulah Bankhead, and what a role to play she was. Wow, that was great. So, yes, and what the theater taught me was the art of warming up your vocal, because rock and roll doesn't treat you like that. A lot of people don't do the warm-ups. There was a vocal warm-up that they gave me to do in Annie, Get Your Gun, and I've done it ever since. And you laugh your ass off seeing me walking around a festival backstage and going,
That's awesome. But if it's a technique that works for you, that's pretty cool. But you co-wrote, like, why Tallulah Bankhead? Like, you co-wrote this thing. Like, what fascinated you about her? I remember from the movies, I remember seeing her as a kid in the Lucy Show and just knowing the power that this woman, you know.
You just said it. I saw her on a television show near the end of her life, and something affected me about her. And then I started to read about her. I read a couple of biographies, and what I liked about it was, and, you know, you'll say this is very much me, which it is, but anyway, she was before her time. She was bisexual, which I'm not, but bisexual. She was a smoker. She was a drinker. She was the first person to be famous for being famous. She was the first woman to have a big crowd of gay girls loving her. And yet, nobody knew her. So that fascinated me. And that was the whole musical. I went into that persona. Who is she?
Yeah. So
behind the image, you know? So that it fascinated me. And, I had a real good time doing that, real good time playing her. Fantastic.
Well, we are talking to music icon Susie Quattro, and there's more with Susie right here on 720 WGN. Stay player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to rock legend Susie Quattro. You also appeared on, like, British television, Absolutely Fabulous, Dempsey and Makepeace, and And, you know, so you've done some acting, too. I mean, I know when you were doing Happy Days, they offered you a spinoff. Do you like acting? Is that something you like to do, or is that just part of your repertoire as an artist?
I like acting very much. I didn't want to do the spinoff because I figured 3 seasons was enough, and I didn't want Leather Tuscadero to become Susie Quattro and vice versa.
Very smart.
If you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
So I was kind of protecting the Susie Quattro persona by not overdoing the Leather Tuscadero part, you know?
But you've layered on so many different things besides the songwriting and the performing. I mean, you know, radio host, author, you hosted a weekly rock show for the BBC. You've just known how to pivot a little bit and add some things to, you know, what you're doing, you know, to keep, obviously, Susie Quattro out there.
I refuse to be boxed in. I am an artiste,
mm-hmm.
and I say that unashamedly. Mm-hmm. I love everything that being an artiste allows me to do. I was on the radio for 15 years. I even was up for a Radio of the Year Award at the Sony Radio Awards, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Done a lot of acting, like you say, author. I like to create, I like to communicate, I like to entertain. This is what makes me tick. So whatever avenue that takes, I'm fine with it. And don't box me in.
No, I hear you. And the documentary really does lay that all out. It's Susie Q, which does capture every bit of your life story. It must have been, though, pretty cathartic for you to relive all this and go through it. You know, people say when they write and put together something like this that it's really good therapy to work through the ups and downs of life and career.
Oh, God, it is really, yeah. I mean, I did write my autobiography in, I think it was 2006, around
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through it once already in that. But when we were doing this documentary, this was really quite something. I talked to the director, and I laid the ground rules. And I said, even though I have scissors, because it's my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have to have the editing scissors.
Yeah.
I said, I promise you that I will not use them if what is being said is the person's opinion, it's important to the story, and indeed if it's true, I will not use them. And if you want to make a documentary with all these nice people saying nice things about me, you're talking to the wrong girl, because I want my truth. That was my reason for doing it. I want the story to be told, warts and all, and that's what I accomplished. And when I went to premieres, the first few I went to, I swear to God, there must have been 6 or 7 moments when I wanted to go onto the floor and crawl out of the cinema. And that has now ended up, for me, being the most important parts in the documentary.
Look at that. That's awesome.
It's the vulnerable parts, you know, but
yeah.
They're uncomfortable,
yeah.
But they need to be there.
And you worked your way through those. Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
When you look back, you know, and I know you're still doing this, but when you look back at your journey, what are you most proudest of?
Oh, God, I guess the fact that I've been able to have such a long career and been a pinup girl and this and that and this and that and this and still be totally feet on the ground.
Yeah.
I don't
Very
run
true.
On ego. I never have and I never will. I never go on a stage thinking, oh, I'm going to kill them tonight. No, I have to win them tonight. You know, so
yeah.
I'm very much, I am a professional. I love what I do and I'm normal-ish. What's normal. But I am
yeah.
pretty normal.
I like it. Your latest album is called The Devil and Me. When did you start working on the new album, and how did that all come together?
Right. Well, the first album that I did with my son was No Control, which was out in 2019. Everybody went crazy
mm-hmm.
on that one. Never worked with my son before.
That's awesome.
He insisted he wanted to write with me, so we started to do it, and it worked. And the company took up the option for the second album. So 2019, as you know, was a very high year with No Control in the documentary
yeah.
and something like 100 solo sold out shows in iconic venues. It was just great. 2020 should have been even bigger.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the lockdown happened. And my son was going to be on the road with the band he worked with. I was supposed to be on the road. I said, right, Richard, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the best out of the situation. We didn't know when we were going to be able to write the next album. Now we can.
Yeah, good.
So we buckled down. I had built a little studio in my garden, and I had a little patio to work on. So we just started to write. And he put his foot down on this. He got his confidence on the first album. And this album, I call it getting belligerent, you know, which is good. I know.
Yeah.
He kept saying to me, because, you know, he's 36, and he said, okay, Mom. He said, now, I have to tell you now, he said, this album is not going to be like No Control. This album has to be as groundbreaking as your first album. You have to trust me. And he kept saying that over and over. Trust me. And when we got the finished product done, I know what he means now. Because he brought his 36-year-old generation to the table, right?
Yeah.
So different, you know, a little bit different than my generation, naturally. And in his DNA, which is immovable,
yeah,
he brought watching me since as far back as his little brain can remember.
Yeah.
So that's in his DNA, right? So then you put that together, the perfect storm. You put it together with my 70 years age and my 57 years in the business, my life experience. You stick those things together, and we came up with an album that is as groundbreaking as the first one. We did it.
That's awesome.
We did it.
Yeah.
And everybody that worked on No Control, which everybody loved that album, same people worked on this one with us. And at all different times, they said to me, we didn't think you could beat No Control, but you've blown it out the water. So everybody agrees. So I'm glad I trusted my son, and he came up with the goods.
Well, he's got the balls and confidence that you did at that age.
Yeah.
Right?
He does. In fact, you know, real quick, I'll tell you a funny story.
Yeah.
I was putting down the proper vocal on the finished track, My Heart and Soul, I Need You Home from Christmas. And that was the first release. Beautiful, beautiful song. And, you know, when you're in there doing a recording, and or if you're putting down a bass part, whatever you're doing, you're kind of in a vulnerable place because maybe you get it wrong, maybe the note's wrong, maybe this, you know. And so you're kind of a little bit naked. So I'm putting down my vocal. And Richard, my son, he stopped the tape. And I said, what's the matter? And there's people there, you know. And he said, you're not doing it, Mom. So I immediately got defensive and embarrassed. And I said, what do you mean I'm not doing it? He said, well, you're not giving me goosebumps. And then I was really embarrassed. I said, what aren't you getting? And he said, don't get mad, Mom. Listen. And he put the demo vocal I had did in my ears. And I just went, whoa.
Wow.
Excuse me. So what had happened was, when
wow.
I did the when I
wow.
ran out into the studio and just sang on this track he was doing, it was just no thought to it, just from emotional, from the heart. When I was standing in the studio singing, I was being Susie Quattro, putting down the proper vocal on the finished track. A totally different mindset. And he played it for me in my ears. I got it. I did a little wander around the studio, came in, put myself back in that vulnerable position, and sang it like a bird.
I was going to say, I love that he challenged you on that.
He did challenge me.
Yeah.
But how smart, first
yeah.
of all,
yeah.
how musically clever to hear it and
mm-hmm.
vibey that he wasn't getting that, and then to know why he wasn't getting it.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
put me back to the demo. And
yeah.
I did
yeah.
hear it right away. There was no mistake in it.
Yeah.
You could hear it.
That's awesome. That's great. Great partnership there, too.
Yeah, good partnership. And we will work together again and again and again because, well, we're writing for the next album now. I can't seem to stop.
I love it. I love it. Before I let you go, I got to ask you, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame seems like a natural to me, and I'm certainly not alone in this. Crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, to be very bluntly honest about it, I'm just bored with the whole thing now.
Hmm.
When I see the people that aren't in it, I think maybe I'm in better company not being in it.
Ah, interesting. All right, fair enough.
But it's so boring.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it really, in all honesty, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
they
yeah.
you know.
You're everybody's influence.
One, so,
you're everybody's
so,
influence.
So they should
yeah.
honor that. If they don't, they don't.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha. What a thrill. Susie Quattro, the new album is The Devil in Me. The new documentary is Susie Q. And for more on this rock legend, visit SusieQuattro.com. Just an incredible conversation. And honestly, I hope I get to see you perform live in the States soon.
Oh, God, I would love that more than anything. Oh, please, God. Okay, sending it out there, universe. Okay.
I love it.
Nice
love
to talk
it.
To
nice
you.
Nice talking to you, too. Thanks, Susie.
Okay, bye.
Take care. All right, our Women of Rock radio special continues with Pat Benatar, Debbie Harry, Joan Jett, and bonus conversations with Melissa Etheridge, Vicki Peterson, co-founder of the Bangles, and more after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on 720 WGN. All right, we're celebrating the Women of Rock on the Dave Plyer Show, and now the legendary Pat Benatar. She's a four-time Grammy Award winner who started her career in the early 70s, all leading up to her first album, which went gold, and that was Crimes of Passion in 1980. Along the way, the union of Pat Benatar and Neil Spider Giraldo has become one of the most successful in music history. And joining us to talk about their nearly five-decade-long journey are rock legends Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo. Welcome into you both.
Thank you. How you doing?
How you doing today?
I am excellent. Well, I'll tell you, 35 years of working together, playing together, living life together, and I'm going to coin the phrase and be a big geek here, but say love is a battlefield. So far, you guys have won the war.
Well, there is a secret, but if I told you, it wouldn't be a secret. I can't really do that. But you know what? We both thought the same thing before we met. Yeah. But, you know, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. It was kind of the universe playing its hand for us, and we were each other's muse, and thankfully, we became each other's lover right away. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
But he's really nice, too, so that really helps.
She's really nice, too. That
You're
really
so
helps.
Full of it.
That's funny. Spoken like a true married couple. First, I want to dig into this. First with Pat, you know, I know you started singing in grammar school, but you were about 20 years old, and I read this, you were like a bank teller, and you were inspired by a concert you attended to pursue a career in music. What was that concert? Like, what came about there?
I was with a bunch of my fabulous gay friends, and they were going to see Liza Minnelli, and I was working in a bank, and I'd stopped singing, you know, I just was studying voice and everything, but I stopped singing, and, you know, I just, you know, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do with my life. I was, you know, 19 years old, 20 years old, and I was living in Richmond, Virginia, and they wanted to go to a concert. They wanted to go see Liza Minnelli, and they said, sure, why not? I loved her mother, let's go. But when I was there, and I was just sitting in the seats before the show started, I just was looking around and thinking, wow, this is pretty incredible, and you know, it was in the Richmond Coliseum, so it was about, you know, 18,000 people. And she came out and she started singing, doing her thing. And I was thinking, wow, I can do this. I know I can do this. If she can do this, I can do this.
Right.
And that kind of it.
That was kind of it. Now, I know, you know, you sang for a couple of years. You sang with a lounge band called Coxon's Army. What kind of music was that?
It was just all covers, basically. The guy who was the band leader, he wrote some original stuff. But it was really basically a pop band, and it did all cover songs and things like that. You know, it was a bar band. That was it. But it wasn't doing any rock and roll stuff. I mean, I was always trying, but, you know, those guys were kind of middle of the road. So, but I was just happy to be working. So it was good.
I know the band broke up. You drove to New York and you went on stage at open mic night at Catch a Rising Star. What did you sing? What kind of kicked it off that got you discovered?
Nothing that had anything to do with what it ended up as. I sang Rockabye Your Baby. Because like I said, I love Judy Garland, so I sang that. That's what I sang, and everyone went crazy, and it just went from there. But, I mean, it had absolutely nothing to do with what I wanted to do. I was just, you know, so schooled in classical music and theatrical music. So I just picked what I knew, and that's what I did, so.
You know, and I know you did a little Broadway, too, at the time, some off-Broadway stuff. It was with Beverly D'Angelo, who I had on the show, by the way, a couple months ago, and Christine
Great.
Lottie. And you also created, you know, you created a look for yourself that kind of defined who Pat Benatar is.
Yeah, that was just a Halloween costume that just evolved, and it worked. It was just an idea. We went out on Halloween, and we went back up to Catch, but we stayed in our costumes, and I performed that night in the costume that I wore, and it just had such a reaction that I thought, maybe I should try this again the next night. So I did, and I kept doing it over and over again, and then it evolved, and it became what everybody recognizes as the beginning thing, and,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was crazy. You know, we're 25 years old. How old are you, Spider? 22?
21. 20. When you were 25, I was 21.
Yeah.
So you went a little younger.
We were
Pat.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, you were just doing crazy. And then and we met. You know, then everything started to solidify, and we started to really hone in on what we were doing, and that's when it really got, you know, to where it is what you all know now.
Yeah. So. Well, I know you were doing some jingles. You were working with advertisers. You were performing in clubs, and you got this record deal with Chrysalis. And now you also met with this record deal. All came along a very important person in your life, and that's Spider. Now, Spider, how did you and Pat meet? What do you remember from that first time?
I was playing with Rick Derringer at the time, and we were on an American tour. We did Canada as well, but we were on the road, and what happened was I finished doing a record for Rick. I played most piano on it because I played a lot of piano as well. And then I was told of a singer that got signed to a record company that wanted to form a rock and roll band. I was looking for a partner. And the person that was scheduled to produce the record, after a failed attempt by another producer, says, well, I know this young guy because he's finished a record with Rick Derringer. That's me. He says, I want you to go and meet this person. I just had no idea it was going to be a girl. I just maybe I've heard of him before. And even though you didn't hear him because it's a her. And I went, oh. So I was sent down basically to meet Patricia and to talk over the idea of forming a band because she wasn't in any type of rock and roll band at that time. So, and then I heard a voice and I says, well, you got such a good voice. I hope I don't ruin it by rock. A little bit too. But, you know, of course, it held up great. So that's kind of how it
happened. How did we meet?
How did we meet? Well, that's it. We met at SIR in New York City. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was on my way back to Cleveland. And that's where I was from.
Right.
I had some time off because I finished the record with Rick and I was going to go on the road with him shortly, like after a couple months. So I had a little time off. So I was on my way to the airport, and the record company called and said, listen, just signed this girl. You know, I heard about you. We'd love for you to come down and meet her. And that's what I did. I drove down. I says, well, if I don't get along with her, if it don't work out, can I get another ticket back to Cleveland because I'll miss my flight? He says,
yeah.
Not only will I give you a ticket back, if it don't, he says, I will put you in a hotel because it will work.
That's awesome. That's the confidence level they had. Well, Pat's from New York. You're from Cleveland. Spider, what are some of the music that was inspiring you when you were just a kid?
Well, there was quite a bit. One was my Uncle Tim, who basically lived with me at my parents' house. He was 4 years older than me, and he got me into all the early British guitar-driven rock bands like the Kinks and then the Who and, you know, on and on, the Yardbirds. So those bands really affected me as a guitar player. And then I loved Chuck Berry, but I liked the piano almost a little bit more than a guitar, which is odd to say. So that fueled my piano stuff. And then I had a lot of blues things that I got to because my mother would take me to five and dime stores, and for 99 cents I can buy 10 45 records.
Right, you sure could.
I never knew what the inside was. I knew what the outside was. Well, I didn't even know who those were. So I was listening to Muddy Waters and Johnny Hooker. I had no idea who these people were.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
They all played a part into the thing. You know, the part of the beauty of our relationship that works so well is we're coming from two diverse places of music.
Right.
And
right.
That's what makes it so special for us, because by joining, we pull each other both into the middle. And that's the special thing that makes it work for us.
Spider, when did you start playing? How old were you?
I was 6 years old for guitar. I was 10 years old for piano. And then I started beating drums when I was about 13.
Now, Pat, who were some of your inspirations growing up?
In popular music and rock and roll, it was definitely Led Zeppelin and John Lennon. But I liked a lot of the Motown stuff. I liked the showmanship of all that Motown stuff and the harmonies and, you know, a lot of the melodic stuff that was going on with Motown. And then, of course, you know, I was studying opera. So, I mean, you know, all of that. I mean, that gave me all the stamina and the strength and the... You know, the range
technique.
And everything. Yeah, all the technique that I needed to do, which I had no idea it was going to help me, but it actually did. Right. And, you know, I loved theatrical music. I was in a lot of productions in that way, and I still do. You know, Spider was married 33 years, and he still can't believe he's married to a woman who lives in the South Pacific in the car. You know what I mean?
So, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, and I know, too, you know, you played Spider with so many other artists over the years too, Kenny Loggins and John Waite, but this was an enduring friendship and a relationship that not only melded professionally but personally as well. But it helped kick off that first album, and I think this might be surprising to everybody, but I mean every album since. I mean you've really been together from the very beginning, and the first album was In the Heat of the Night, which included Heartbreaker and We Live for Love. I mean that was a big album.
Yeah, that was a big one. Well, see, when I was introduced to Patricia, she didn't have a band. There was nobody there. She was signed, and the record company basically said, you know, listen, if you got a song, just do it together. The management used the term musical director, but musical director is so, I always felt that was a term that should be like Janet Jackson would have a musical director. Rock bands don't have musical directors. They have a guitar player and a singer.
Gotcha.
And they form the band. So what we did is once we met and we both understood where we were going to go with this thing, then we called in a bunch of musicians and we formed the band to take it out from New York to California.
We just worked together right from the hat. I mean, even if they weren't actually getting it, which they weren't, you know, I'd explained it like 8 billion times what I was going to do, try to be, you know, like Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and, you know, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. I wanted this partnership on stage so I wasn't just some, you know, solo female artists on stage. You know, they really were not getting it. They had an idea in their mind, but the point is it didn't matter because Spider and I had the idea, and we started from that point. And everything that we did as a duo. You know, unfortunately, in the beginning, it wasn't portrayed like that, but, you know, we spent many, many years, you know, clarifying that so that everybody would really understand what it really meant.
We are celebrating the women of rock on the Dave Plyer Show. Susie Quattro, Debbie Harry, and Joan Jett. And right now we're talking to Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo. So your first gold album was Crimes of Passion with major hits that really put you on the map. Hit Me With Your Best Shot was immediately a top 10 hit.
Yeah, that was crazy. That was a gold single. Crimes of Passion went multi-platinum 5 times. And even Heat of the Night went platinum, so it was really, it was exciting. I mean, it was just, you know, I mean, it was a little unnerving because, you know, we'd only been together a short time, and everything started to accelerate really, you know, quickly. And we made Heat of the Night in 28 days.
Yeah,
28 days.
Wow.
And we went right on the road, and the record just, you know, went crazy, and Heartbreaker was, you know, climbing up the charts. So we spent the next, you know, 3 years chasing ourselves because we had to go back in and we made Crimes of Passion, and that just cemented everything, and it went insane. So, I mean, it was really exciting, but it was really crazy. And
I bet.
Well, Crimes of Passion was a good second record to make because what it was 8 months or 7 months of being on the road with the same band, not just a formed band to go in the studio. So that we basically translated the live band sound to the record, and that's kind of what we were going for, which was kind of easy because we did that fast as well. So that was a good thing for the right time.
But it didn't give us any time to worry about like the sophomore jinx. There was no time for that.
Right.
So it was really great because you had no fear. Not because you were arrogant or anything, but it never even occurred to you there was no time to be afraid. So
right, yeah.
You just went in there and did it, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And that's, I think that's what makes that sophomore album so much more special, especially what you say, Neil, about the whole thing that you guys got to know each other. You got to know how to play with each other. There was a feeling there, and you knew how to do it. And you took a little more time on this album, not 28 days, but you took a little more time to spend on something.
A little bit more, not much.
Not so much, but there was a synergy, you know? I mean, it was happening from playing. We were out on the road for almost 14 months. It was a long time.
No.
So.
No, we did that in, I think it was in March or April of 1980. We were only on the road for like 4 or 5 months.
That year we were on for sure.
Yeah, and actually when that record finished, that's when Rick Springfield called me up and said, hey, could come in the studio? I want you to do a couple songs for me. And that's where Jesse's Girl came from.
Yeah, it was a pretty electric time.
Crazy time. Well, speaking of that, like, when did you feel like you made it? Like, was it the first album? Was it the second one? Was it the first top 10 single? Was it the album going gold? I know it was the Grammy. You both were on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. Like, what made you say, holy cow, we're here?
It started even with Heat of the Night because, you know, like, you have to remember back then there was no internet or any of that stuff. So you had to wait every week to find out when Billboard came out. You got a day lead time on where your album was. But you literally had to wait for that magazine to come out. And so you would wait, you know, every week, and it was going up the charts. But we were so, you know, focused and busy because we were touring. I mean, we were playing, I don't know, 5-6 shows a week. It was insane. But we drove up, one time we were in Virginia Beach, and we drove up to this club. You have to understand, we're still playing clubs at this point. And it was, you know, very soon after the record was released, but we drove up to this club, and there were all these people. There were barricades, and people were throwing things, and they were running all over the place. There were cops everywhere, and I'm thinking, oh, what could possibly have happened? And it was because the club had oversold the seats, and people were going crazy because they couldn't get in.
Wow.
And I think for me, that was the moment I was like,
And then it just accelerated from then.
They went crazy.
It just went quick. But, you know, one funny thing is that we had a, you know, of course, we're living together, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Toyota that was rented because our business manager told us, after the record went gold, the business manager said, Heat of the Night went gold. He says, don't get too full of yourself. Just, you can't afford a new car yet.
We
rented a Toyota.
That's awesome. Well,
and shared it.
And shared it, yeah.
I was going to say, that probably kept you grounded, right?
We were pretty grounded.
We were really grounded.
I think they kept us working so much that they didn't want us to ever start to think.
That's awesome.
And it worked out.
It worked out it
was
okay.
It was a record every 9 months.
Yeah.
If you look at the history of it.
I saw that, yeah.
One record, nine months.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. We are celebrating the women of rock on the Dave Plyer Show. Susie Quattro, Pat Benatar, Debbie Harry, and Joan Jett. And there's more with Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo next on 720 WGN. We are celebrating the women of rock on the Dave Plyer Show. Susie Quattro, Debbie Harry, and Joan Jett. And right now we are talking to Pat Benatar and Neil Spider Giraldo. Spider, you played many of the instruments, but you were very involved behind the scenes. You were kind of the Desi Arnaz also with Lucy, because he did all the production stuff as well and played a bunch of
hands. Everything.
I act more like Lucy.
You have to be Lucy, but he definitely did everything. I mean, he did all the grunt work. You know, he did it. He was in there. He was the mad scientist, you know, and I was his muse, and I would come in there and, you know, throw in my parts. But he would be in there, you know, 16, 18 hours a day. He was...
Yeah.
Well, because I cared about a song most. That's the most important thing. I wasn't self-serving ever. In fact, the record company at one point says, will you please start playing more guitar? At one point, they said, you're playing too much. They said, can you play more? Because I'm more interested in the song. You know,
he was always a producer. He didn't even know that. I mean, he began as the guitarist, but he just, the minute he realized what production meant and all of the creativity that went with it and how, you know, you could really, you know, form, you know, ideas and all of that stuff that goes on in his head all day. I mean, it was a perfect venue for him, and you know, he just took to it, you know, like it was so natural. He just
I knew it all along because I didn't really care about being the greatest guitar player in the world. Never I didn't want that. I just wanted to be a musician. I love piano, I love guitar, I love drums, I love everything. I love arranging, I love producing, I love songs, I love vocals. I mean, I love everything.
He never thought of himself. But it was really great for me too, because all I really wanted to do was sing and write. That was it. And I was so damn bossy. So bossy in every other aspect of our life. So it was really great that he was bossy in there. It really melded
everything. We take turns. Part of the secret that we have to give you is the secret is in the day-to-day life. The wife is, of course, the supreme boss. And then when we get in the studio, the roles reverse.
Yeah,
which is,
that's great.
So it works really well.
It's a nice balance. It's a nice balance. But, you know, it must have made it fun, too, because... You know, not a lot of artists, especially back then in the beginnings, got to have, you know, really control over what they were doing and to have that partnership going on both sides from both, you know, the music side and behind the scenes and everything else. To have that control must have been, you know, pretty gratifying.
And they hated it, too. I got to tell you,
they did.
Crazy. They thought I was a pain. They thought I was a pain in the ass before he got there. He got there. We were like the unholy alliance. They wanted to shoot themselves in the head.
That's awesome.
They were happy until songs were hits. But, that, you know, that's okay. That's okay because, you know, I always believed that I didn't like to make records when you heard it the first time you knew it was a hit. I wanted to make records where after you heard it for the fourth time, because if you hear it after the fourth time, you're a real believer.
Yeah.
You're hooked, and it's going to fly. And that's the way I always looked at it. I didn't want that immediate, like, oh, yeah, this is going to be great. Nah, I want a short shelf life. I wanted to keep running. So,
well,
and it worked out great. You know, you got to take a few punches to win the fight. Okay, we're all right. We're still standing.
But you said, you know, you were doing an album every, like, 9 months. So you continued in 81 with Precious Time. You know, it was a second Grammy. Lead single, Fire and Ice, went double platinum. It hit number one. You know, not only did it ground your music partnership, but then, boom, you were married.
Correct. Yeah. The only problem that I had with the 9 month, you know, record pregnancy is what we used to call it, was that we never had enough time to write as many songs and filter through them. We only had a short time to write them. And, you know, listen, I've written almost over 100 songs for us, and I wish I would have had more time to be able to write better stuff when I needed to, rather than just stuck where you have 12 songs, 14 songs.
Right.
I would have rather had 25 songs.
Well, they didn't give you enough time to. They forced our hand, and you know, there's probably, out of the, I don't know, 15 records that were made, there probably should have only been 8. You know, because we, you know, some of the songs were never evolved, and had we had more time, we would have consolidated them, and you would have got 8 spectacular records
instead of
15, you know, records with like 5 great songs, and then all these other songs that really never, you know, made it to where they should have gone. But, you know, that's it. You know, it doesn't matter. It's all done, and it was good.
Yeah. And the marriage thing just happened. I mean,
Well, we had to do that. That was ridiculous.
You had to, yeah.
We met and
it was over.
And we were together, which we were together before we even hit the first gig on stage. I told Patricia, I says, why don't we just get married? She goes, you're nuts. So then a year and a half goes by, and I'm finishing up producing a record for John Waite, and then I ask the wife to marry, and she goes, what took you so long? I can't win. You see what I mean?
That's awesome. No, that's
we were busy.
You were very, very, very busy. But, we're bumping in, with music, your music, for these three segments. And you say, you churned out a lot of music, and I wish we had more time. But I had a hard time figuring out, like, if I'm going to pick three, Benatar Giraldo songs to bump into these interviews, I had a hard time figuring out what songs, because there were so many great iconic songs.
That help.
Three's tough.
Three's hard, but you got to pick Heartbreaker. Heartbreaker's got to be.
Heartbreaker is a good one.
Promises in the Dark, probably.
Oh, that's good. In Battlefield.
Battlefield.
Really
I would pick those three.
All right.
You got True Love, then you got all kinds.
Right. See, it's difficult. When you're getting to three, it's difficult. Then
it's hard at night. You should see how hard it is to pick for the show. It's impossible.
Pretty hard, yeah.
I bet. No, we'll talk about that, too. And then you did Get Nervous, which I know you did, was Shadows of the Night, but A Little Too Late, believe it or not, is still one of my favorites. And I love that song.
Oh, that little song.
Yeah. And 83, you did Live from Earth, and that was Love is a Battlefield. And then it came 84's Tropico with We Belong. I mean, it was just Invincible was coming. I mean, it was just non-stop. Did the success of these, it was, 7-8 years, these first albums coming out. Was it a little overwhelming? Did it get to you both, or did you pretty much keep your heads above water?
Yeah, we were fine.
Yeah, I mean, the music part of it was never an issue, and we were so lucky. I mean, we worked really hard. It wasn't, we were focused, and we were working hard, but joyfully, because we really enjoyed it. But I mean, the only part that was ever hard was the business aspect and how difficult they made it for us as a couple. Because they were threatened by our alliance, and
right.
Instead of, looking at it a really positive thing, they wanted more control, and that was never going to happen. But the rest of it was great. The music part was great. In between there, we had our first baby. I mean, our life was good. It was we were enjoying every minute of it, And once we got a real control over everything after 1990, when we really controlled it, then it got to be a lot more fun.
I'm sure. Well, Pat and Neil are hitting the road again. And for more on tours, music, and more, visit BenatarGiraldo.com. Can't wait to see you on stage again, especially here in Chicago.
That'd be great.
Thanks Dave. We're looking forward to coming.
All right. Thanks again. Much more ahead on 720 WGN. We are celebrating the women of rock on the Dave Plyer Show. Susie Quattro, Pat Benatar, Debbie Harry, and now rock icon Joan Jett. One of rock and roll's legends got her first guitar when she was only 14 years old. She became a founding member of the Runaways in 1975, and then she formed Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, where her first hit was a song we opened with, I Love Rock and Roll. That was back in 1982, and it went to number one for 7 weeks in a row. She formed Black Hawk Records, and she also gives back by touring for the past 20-plus years for the USO. She's an innovator on the music scene and named by Rolling Stone magazine as one of the greatest guitarists of all time, and that is Joan Jett. Hey there, Joan.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Excellent. Hey, thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So, Joan, I want to talk to you how it all started for you. So you got your first guitar, and that was really the beginning of all this.
Right. Well, I think I was 13, because then my family moved to L.A. and when I was 14. So I got it, the Christmas when I was 13, yeah.
And what were you being taught at the time? What kind of music were you playing?
I wasn't playing anything. I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the radio, hearing songs like, I remember the song All Right Now by The Free.
Mm-hmm.
Really was one of the songs that made me want to make those sounds. It was something about the rhythm guitar in that song. It kind of bends slightly out of tune at points, and I don't know, it hit me right in the crotch, but at 13, I didn't know that. It was just something that made me want to learn how to make those sounds. So I asked my parents for an electric guitar for Christmas and was very pleasantly surprised when they actually got me one, a Sears Silvertone. And so I went to go take guitar lessons, and, being really excited about it, I wanted the guy to teach me rock and roll the first day. And So I don't know if he was just kind of doing this because I was a girl, asking to learn how to play rock and roll, or if this is what he would teach any kid. But he said, no, we got to learn on top of Old Smokey. So he tried to teach me on top of Old Smokey, and I sat through that lesson, and that was the last lesson I took, and I went and bought one of Learn How to Play Guitar by Yourself books and sat down with my records and kind of learned how to play bar chords and would try to learn along with my records. And most of those early ones were things like Black Sabbath or Smoke on the Water was a big one because the big, fat, easy chords. I think every guitar player learns how to play Smoke on the Water. And so that was probably some of the early things. Or Bang a Gong by T-Rex was another big one. And so that's kind of what started me out. And then my family moved from Maryland to California, and to the Los Angeles area. And it was at this point that I realized, oh, my God, if I want to be in a band, I could actually really make it happen. In Los Angeles, there must be other people that play instruments. And if I play guitar, there's got to be other girls out here that want to do what I want to do.
And that really, that really opened it up for you. And I know you were hanging out, or a night spot that really caught your attention was Ronnie Bingenheimer's English Disco, right?
Yes. It was a very special place. It was a disco for teenagers. They didn't serve liquor, and if you were over 21, you were just kind of too old. So it was definitely geared towards kids, and they would play all the British singles that American kids never heard. So you'd hear Bowie and a band called The Sweet, or Slade, or Suzy Quatro, T-Rex, and just tons of great English music that American kids never heard. 3-minute hit songs with big choruses and hand claps, and it was really catchy stuff. And so that is, you know, kind of inspired me, along with that early stuff that I told you about with the Deep Purple and Black Sabbath, mixed with the New York Dolls and all this glitter stuff. And that kind of became my style.
And soon, you know, I mean, after that, when you got there, 74, 75, you founded the Runaways with Lita Ford, Jerry Curry, Sandy West, Jackie Fox. It became huge, and you began touring quickly, like with Cheap Trick and Van Halen. Did that success come pretty fast for you?
Well, we played right away. I mean, literally within a month of the Runaways forming, we were doing shows. First, we were a three-piece, and that was in, I'd say, September of 75. And then by that December, we had changed the lineup and auditioned Sheree and Jackie Fox, and we became the five-piece. And, you know, we did go on tour right away, and we had a record deal right away on Mercury Records. So
that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
And, you know, Kim Fowley was handling some of that stuff, so I'm not really quite sure how, that came about. But the touring, we toured with a lot of a variety of bands, you know, everything from, like you said, Van Halen to, you know, Cheap Trick. We did gigs with Cheap Trick while they were playing the material from their first album. So that was like a really special time as well.
I know you had mentioned before, and I've seen some interviews with you before, that you felt like, you know, at the time, the Runaways, you didn't feel like you had a lot of direction. I mean, you were kind of on your own figuring things out.
Yeah, pretty much. We were just, for me, it was all about the gigs. I wasn't really thinking much beyond that, which could have been good or could have been bad. You know, about thinking about my career and what would happen after the Runaways, I just was kind of focused on really what was right in front of me. You know, writing the songs, doing the shows. I wasn't really thinking about the business or how that worked or anything like that. I was, since I was one of the songwriters, I did get, you know, money through publishing.
I mean, you were concerned about the music more than itself. You weren't
absolutely
worried about
yeah.
the business end.
That was my main concern, but I wasn't, you know, thinking into the future about, oh my God, what happens after this band, or, you know, how long can this go on, or anything like that.
But you were young and quite frankly, living for the moment, which you should do at
exactly.
that age.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I know, you know, in the 1970s, and I know you experienced, you know, your fill of sexism in the music industry, you know, girls playing rock and roll, it just doesn't happen. How many times did you hear that?
Thousands.
Yeah.
And you still, people don't voice it as much, but it's more, that energy is still out there.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. I mean, you know, you don't see, you know, the music scene has not changed that much. It's not like you've got, you know, girls in bands playing guitar now that are successful. The thing is, they're out there. They're all over the place. They're in every city, every big city, every small town. You've got girls in bands, whether it's an all-girl band or a girl in a band with guys playing rock and roll. They're out there. It's just, you know, I guess it's got to be sexism. I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
yeah.
When I started in this, I figured rock and roll is a sort of a free sort of medium. People wouldn't give you crap for playing guitar. You know, they'd be accepting, and I was completely wrong. You know, I thought people would be excited to see girls playing guitars. I was wrong. But I'm not talking about the fans. I'm talking about something within the industry, something within the power structure that doesn't like it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking it's more the labels themselves that just couldn't move the needle on this fast enough. Because I know you were told many times, you know, lose the guitar, change your style, your look, everything else. You know, well, the Joan Jett Experience is, you know, the punk rock, glam rock look and the music. I mean, it's a package deal. It all comes together.
Exactly. And girls have testosterone, too. So, I mean, you know, they can wail and play rock and roll. You know, it's just, it's down to the individual.
Because the industry rejected Joan, we are one of the few bands on the planet that own big hits.
Yeah.
Very few. And Joan's, you know, how many women, I don't know if there's any, that own, she owns I Love Rock and Roll. The Rolling Stones don't even own Satisfaction. The Beatles don't own Let It Be. But we own I Love Rock and Roll, and that's only because nobody wanted it.
So. Actually, in a way, it's kind of like the rock and roll gods were looking out for us to kind of to forge this new path. So nobody did sign us, so we own our own music. Then we were kind of forced to, if we wanted our music out, to form our own label. So that created Blackheart Records, which was really the trunk of Kenny's Cadillac for the first several months. And, you know, and now we're the longest-running indie label in America.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, when you sometimes you think a failure is actually a success. And it just goes to show you that you can't. This goes for anybody out there, you know, that you can't believe. If you believe in something, you've got to go for it. Because people told me I had no songs. These are people that listen to I Love Rock and Roll, Crimson and Clover, Do You Want to Touch Me, Bad Reputation, and they say there were no hits. So is that they can't hear hits, or do they have a preconceived notion and didn't even listen to the music? So you can't let people's negativity stop you when people say it. Because people will always say, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. But why not? And, you know, as long as you're not hurting somebody else, if you don't try something you believe in, and this has to go for anything, not just music. If you want to be an architect or anything, a nuclear physicist, and people are saying, oh, you can't do that, if you don't at least give it a shot, you will always rue the day you didn't go for it. But at least if you go for it and it doesn't turn out the way you thought, at least you've got the satisfaction of knowing you gave it your best shot.
Well, that's why I always found it so damn cool about you, is you never, ever, ever let anyone tell you what to do or let anyone stand in your way, and you found your own path and you got it done.
Thank you.
Well, we are celebrating the Women of Rock on the Dave Plyer Show, and there's more with rock icon Joan Jett next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to rock and roll legend Joan Jett and songwriter and producer Kenny Laguna. Kenny, tell me how you and Joan got together.
I used to be in bubblegum bands, like Tommy James and the Shondells, Led Zeppelin, or bubblegum. And we kind of, this whole group of people that had so many hit records, like Sugar Sugar, Yummy Yummy, Chewy Chewy, anything like that, Moni Moni. So that ended quickly because we were trying to be something else, a little cooler. Remember, we were AM radio hits, and at the time, then the whole world of FM. Where Crosby, Stills and Nash and The Who, and you know. So anyway, at the end of it, I luckily got adopted by The Who, and they had a band I produced for them called the Steve Gibbons Band that had hits in Europe. And the publicist, the American publicist, was the manager of The Runaways and Blondie, and he kept telling me I should meet these girls. They're great, and I was intrigued because I just heard that they were wild, and I was more intrigued with that than I was with, you know, the concept of it than the music, because my style of producing before I met John was more like, you know, we came in and figured out what you're going to sound like and create a sound and get a song and just kind of half craft things, you know. It's like Milli Vanilli was no surprise to me because we did that every day, all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, anyway, we had this manager, and the last album was about to happen. So he told me I could go to Amsterdam from London, where I was, and meet with the girls, and if they liked me, I could produce the record. And I was interested. So I was in the Mayfair Hotel, and when I get down to the lobby checking out, I ran into this guy, Matthew King Kaufman, who's he was head of Berserkly Records, one of the new wave pioneers. And he, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm going to go meet with this band, the Runaways. And he goes, oh, they lost their best person. Why don't you come with me to California? And you can produce Greg Kinn and Earthquake and Jonathan Richmond. And to tell you the truth, it was winter time, and I had the job. So I drove to the airport with him and went to California.
Yeah.
And I didn't meet the Runaways then. And then in the middle of the album, things were falling apart because Lita Ford and Jack and Sandy West were attaching themselves to producer John Alcock, and they wanted to be a heavy metal band. And Joan was more like, you know, totally enamored with the punk scene and the glam scene. So it was falling apart, and he asked me to come in and finish the album, and again I didn't. And then by the end of the year, the Runaways had broken up. And I got a call from this fellow, Toby Mamus, who's Alice Cooper's tour manager today. And he said, the Runaways have broken up. They've all left. Remember, I didn't know one from another, but they've all left except Joan Jett, and she's going to fulfill a contract we have with a movie company that's going to sue us if we don't deliver 6 songs in 8 days. And because I had learned the craft of songwriting, I was a good choice to try to create songs quickly, you know. And so, but again, I wasn't going to go. And then my wife, Merrill, who then became the manager with me, she said, I've been reading about Joan Jett. I think she's going to be a significant person, and you better meet her. So I went from England straight to California, and we met. And the first day I looked at her, she was like so different. And she wasn't in great shape then because, you know, she didn't have any money, and her clothes were kind of like what you look like when you don't have a lot of money.
My band had broken up. I was shrinking. I wasn't taking care of myself. Go on, Kenny.
I was going to leave the bloated out, but as long as you broke
it. No. So, that's what it was.
Yeah. So, but she walked in the room, and it was like her presence was awesome. You know, she had a motorcycle jacket, you know, and it was just, it was very uncommon. And then we went in the studio, we created these songs, and some of them, like You Don't Know What You Got, made the Bad Reputation album, awesome stuff, with a great energy, and she started singing, and when she went, oh, baby, and she did that, and it reminded me of the great Darlene Love, who I worked with,
mm-hmm.
and there was something about her, the ability to let it all hang out, but still be cool. You know, you don't look like a jerk, you know, because some people let it all hang out and they look like jerks. It's just over. But she had that cool thing going on, like rock and roll is really that way, where you could, you know, and she wasn't restricted by trying to be dainty like a girl's supposed to be
yeah.
in the singing groups, you know. And so I was really impressed with that. And then I said, listen, you overdub your guitar later. I'll take these session guys and we'll create the track. And she says to me, no, then there ain't going to be a record. I'm going to play on the track. And so we went into the studio, and I was like, what, are you crazy? I'm your only hope. She goes, I'd rather just be a bum than give up my my independence as an artist. So I was like, whoa, this is really something. And we became very tight, and we went from there.
We are celebrating the Women of Rock on the Dave Plyer Show, and there's more with rock icon Joan Jett next on 720 WGN. We are celebrating the Women of Rock on the Dave Plyer Show. Susie Quattro, Pat Benatar, Debbie Harry, and right now we're talking to rock legend Joan Jett and songwriter and record producer Kenny Laguna. We were talking about dealing with sexism in the 1970s, Joan. You did feel like you experienced that, even with those who were close to you at the time.
So here's another guy, my best friend here, Kenny Laguna, we weren't best friends yet, being the same sexist that all these other people were.
Right.
It wasn't a sexist.
No, it was, Kenny. Yes, it was, Kenny. You wanted me to...
We did that with the guy singers, too. It's like,
doesn't matter.
You're the songwriter, artist. You eat overdub. Listen, we did a Bo Diddley record called Bo Diddley 1969, and Bo Diddley didn't play guitar.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Maybe it's just the way I read it, but you were just saying another line like every other guy did. Like,
let
us men do the basic track, and then you can come in and put on your girl guitar. And it was like, dude, I'm on the basic track, or there's no record. That's the way it goes.
My mother was a Greenwich Village communist feminist, Joni. Please.
I know, but that's how it went. Then Kenny got it, and then he saw me play, and then we were on the same team. And I'm sure maybe there wasn't anything sexist in it, but once he saw, you know, it in action, then it was like I had somebody there to fight with me, you know, because I was all alone before that, and I was flailing, and I didn't know what to do or how to continue. How do I do this, you know, when everyone already thinks you're a failure at 18 or 19?
So Joan Jett and the Blackhearts were formed, and you had your first hit, I Love Rock and Roll, which really opened the door to a much wider audience. I assume the experience back then and the immediate success that followed was pretty surreal for you.
It was surreal because we weren't really aware of what was going on. We were just out playing the clubs, and we put out I Love Rock and Roll in November of 2001. Very slow time normally in the record industry, and we just went on the road in the following year, started touring relentlessly like we normally do, and I'm not sure at what point. I think, you know, people were working the records. We had a lot of support. It was in the days when radio used to take requests, and so we had a lot of support from our local WNEW here in New York. There were a couple of stations on Long Island. There was WLIR and WBAB that was very supportive and actually playing, you know, us because we were local. And it gave us, you know, I guess a little edge to actually have our songs on the radio. So when we'd play gigs in Long Island or in New York or New Jersey, our crowds were growing. And I can't say enough how big that support from the radio was, and the fact that the kids were calling up and requesting it, and the stations listened and would play
the indie labels did not get on the radio. We were the first to do a concert with WNEW, the big rock station in Manhattan, and we were very lucky that at that moment in time the radio stations were maybe fed up with the old wave, and they were like looking for new things, which led to what they called the new wave.
But there's one thing to be said to be heard on radio, but also it was also the dawn of MTV, so people got to see Joan and see her perform and see what she looked like, and you know, with the kick-ass, you know, outfits and her style and so forth. I think that delivered it more from MTV's perspective than even radio did at the time.
You know, the truth is that MTV started around the time that we started, and we were in their studio the first day that they opened it, and we were friends with Les Garland and Gail Sparrow, mm-hmm. and Don Sykes, and a bunch of guys that and girls that were trying to survive like we were, because we didn't know that we were going to succeed. It seemed like we were doing good, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger, but we could not get a record deal. Remember, that's all we wanted was a record deal. We weren't really thinking about, you know, we wanted to get off of Blackheart Records,
yeah,
and get into a label so that we could be like, you know, the bigger bands. And so radio, we had 50 mainstream stations. It was unheard of for an indie band. 15 mainstream stations. Then after we succeeded, I was old school. I didn't, even though we were friends with these guys and hanging with them, I didn't want to give them the video because I felt like, you know, rock and roll is a radio thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you don't want to show them. We're not the, you know, we weren't the monkeys, and we weren't, you know, the like the Ricky Nelson thing. You know, we were something else. We were a band. And so we didn't give them the video. And I Love Rock and Roll was number one for 4 weeks, and Les Garland came over to the office and said, you know, this is why you should try it. So I said, okay, you're only allowed to play it 2 times a day, and we'll see what happens. And it really worked, like you say. It worked to our advantage because then all of a sudden, as radio was kind of burning this record, suddenly there was a video.
Yeah.
And then, yes, that brought it to the stratosphere. And, of course, they didn't care about their deal for what was I going to do, sue Warner Chappell? It was Warner Brothers at the time. So they started playing it like 20 times a day, and basically they had it. There was nothing we could do. And in the end, it worked out really amazingly, and it was a circumstance, you know, that we...
And timing, you know, yeah. It's just like you can never know that, you know, that moment in time is...
But David's right. It was one of the first, you were one of the first rock stars, forget about female rock stars, you were one of the first rock stars on MTV.
On MTV,
right.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember you hosting, forgive me if I'm wrong here, but didn't you host a New Year's Eve special, like you had your own New Year's Eve special on MTV? Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, Dome was the first act to ever play live on MTV.
Yeah.
And it was that, I think it was 84 to 85 or 83 to 84 was mm-hmm. one of those years. And it was the first live show they did, and Joan was the first act. We were the headliners, so we chose where we wanted to be. And I thought, you know, it'd be great if we do the last sound check and then we play first, so we'll have our stuff all set up. And that was a good plan until David Lee Roth walked across the stage and crushed all our wires.
That's nice. That's nice. Well, you guys got like 20 albums plus albums under your belt. You know, Joan Jett after the Runaways. Is there a favorite for either of you guys as far as whether it was the favorite to put together, the music itself, the touring at the time, the exposure that you had? Like, what's some of your favorite stuff that you've put together to get?
Well, for me, it usually is the last album I did, you know, and in this case, I feel that right now. I'm really proud of our latest album, Unvarnished, and obviously I'm living all the songs because I'm in a different stage in my life, and these songs reflect where I'm at now, so I feel very close to them, and I think it's some of the best music that I've written, but that doesn't really take away from all the other records because at each point they were my favorite too.
Well, I'll tell you, what, the exposure that I got hearing you play some of the songs off the new album was seeing you on television, back to television. I know we talk about radio here, but you know, I love seeing you on Letterman a few weeks ago. I love seeing you on Craig Ferguson with Drew Carey.
Right.
That was the exposure I got. And first of all, you look fabulous. I got to tell you that.
Thank you.
But you sound great and just as entertaining as always. I've seen you in concert many times. In fact, I was in the music business on the retail side for about 12, 15 years, and I met you a long time ago. It was maybe mid to late 80s. We actually had dinner together with your uh-huh. entourage. It was a long time ago. But I just remembered how excited I was to see you perform live because it was 3,000 times better than even watching it on MTV.
Well, see, that's how I feel in general about music. I think making records is lovely, but it's a way for me to get to the road.
Yeah.
You know, I really enjoy making records and putting them out and creating the songs and figuring out the parts. But the thing that really gets me going is that connection that you have with the audience. You know, you're playing these things live. It's in the moment. It's right there, and you see people's faces, and they're smiling, and hopefully, mm-hmm. or just, you know, experiencing the music. And it's just, obviously, it's a unique experience for each person. And I want to make that a special experience for them, so they can go home and, you know, maybe with a pic or, you know, that they had a direct eye contact or so, you know, something that's unique to them that they can carry with them forever. Because that's what I always look for when I would go to shows.
You know, you're a legend. You're an absolute legend. And I know. Does that make you uncomfortable? Does that freak you out to know that you're a legend in rock and roll?
Well, it's hard for me to believe it. It's nice to hear it, but it's, you know, I don't know how much I really believe it on one level. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's very nice. I mean, it's hard to say, yeah, thanks, I'm a legend.
Yeah.
Because I just don't, I don't feel, I mean, I know I've done things and I've influenced people and stuff, but I just would never say that about myself, you know? It's that's things for other people to say, but it's a good feeling.
Well, the closest you can see Joan this summer is up in Milwaukee on the Summerfest grounds at the American Family Insurance Amphitheater. For more on Joan, visit joanjett.com. Great talking to you again, Joan and Kenny.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for having us, Dave.
All right, it's 720 WGN. Long before Madonna and decades before Lady Gaga hit the music scene with their sexually charged songs, edgy costumes, and incredible onstage performances, Debbie Harry reigned supreme as the lead singer of Blondie, a band that came straight out of the mid to late 70s New York CBGB punk scene and skyrocketed to stardom with the disco-infused new wave anthem Heart of Glass. But it was Debbie's classic beauty and sassy, gritty, streetwise attitude both personally and in her music that turned Blondie into a hit-making machine, selling more than 40 million records. Blondie was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006, and now nearly 50 years later, they are still making new music and touring for fans across the globe. Joining us to share that journey is Debbie Harry. Hey, Deb.
Hi. How are you, David?
I am thrilled and honored to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's great to be around. We were just out here in L.A. working on new music, so I'm all, you know, stoked.
Very cool. Well, you know, you changed so much in rock and pop music. You were the first female rock singer who was not only beautiful but extremely talented and just edgy and completely incredibly cool.
Thank you very much. It's a, a lot to live up to.
No, it's totally true. And you have lived up to that. So, you know, I know, you know, as a teenager, you grew up in suburban New Jersey and you would venture into the West Village and you would check out the theater scene when you were younger. And you really wanted to be a part of that. You wanted to be a part of something exciting.
Well, you know, I think I was really trying to explore, you know, what was going on in the art world and in theater, I guess. And I like to read a lot. You know, I was sort of an avid reader, and you know, seeing all these different articles about the scene in New York, and it all seemed very wonderful and magical to me. So of course I had to go and check it out.
But you know, and I know, and I've seen you do some interviews before. You know, you were kind of, and I've seen you quoted as being saying you were kind of oversexed, really charged, and you really wanted to get out of your suburban town, and that's kind of what ventured you into New York. New York was kind of your calling.
Well, I think so. You know, but I have to honestly say that. You know, even as a tiny little girl, you know, like a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old, I was fortunate enough to live in that area and was taken by my family into the city for big holidays, you know, like a real tourist.
Sure.
And, you know, to go see the big tree at Rockefeller Center or to go to see the Easter show at Rockefeller, you know, at the theater. So I would... you know, I had those things, you know, be feeding me, you know, sort of the I knew that it was all there and it was so, so wonderful and so big and, you know, just such a magnetic force to me that, you know, I had to be a part of it.
Well, you moved there in 65, big music scene at the time. You joined a folk group in the late 60s called Wind in the Willows as a backup singer. What got you into that group?
Well, my best friend from high school actually... was married to the founder of that band, of that group. And so I was just, you know, hanging around with her. And, you know, he would be writing songs or something like that. And I, you know, started singing like a high harmony or something. And, you know, I just sort of fell into that. I can't really say that I was a creative force in that band or that group.
Well, and you did that. You were a go-go dancer. You were Playboy Bunny for a little bit. But from 69 to 73, you kind of took a little bit of a break, and then you jumped back in. What made you give yourself some breathing room there?
Well, I don't know. I didn't. I guess I had to, you know, find another approach into that thing. I sort of felt uncomfortable in the music business, and I think that it was sort of a case of misdirection at first. And, you know, I guess that I didn't really identify with it, you know, creatively, and did not feel comfortable. I felt misrepresented, you know, in that era, I guess, and I had to sort of wait until there was
the right thing came along.
Yeah, a big empty spot where something new could be, you know, brought out.
Sure. Well, you joined the Stilettos in 74. You met your longtime collaborator, Chris Stein, and then you then came Angel and the Snake, and then Blondie. How did Blondie come about?
Well, we had the name Angel and the Snake, and we had, just tossed around different names, and we knew that Angel and the Snake wasn't going to really work. Felt a little too cumbersome and perhaps retro at that time. And Blondie sort of seemed so direct and to the point and sort of a little bit weird and crazy.
Yeah.
After the comic strip. And I don't know, it seemed somehow appropriate.
Is that what the name came from?
It was, yeah, well, partially, I think it was... just because, you know, I had bleached my hair and,
sure.
You know, people started saying, "Hey, Blondie." So it seemed pretty obvious. But I also felt that, you know, when you choose a name like that, you sort of have to find something that's already registers in people's minds.
Sure.
As if you were, you know, trying to do something that's commercial or, you know, has commercial potential, that, you know, it has to be sort of something that already exists in people's minds. But yet, it's, you know, has the potential also to be unique.
And tell me about the music club, the legendary music club, CBGB, country, bluegrass, and blues that you kind of really broke out in. And I was looking at the lineup. I mean, it was you, it was the Ramones, it was Talking Heads, it was later Elvis Costello, the Police, Joan Jett. What an iconic venue this was.
Yes, it was very exciting. Television came out of there. A lot of... Patty played there as well.
Yeah.
A lot of it was quite a good music scene. I think, you know, as music scenes go, you know, as with, you know, the San Francisco scene and the LA scene, they sort of gather momentum. You know, it becomes people are drawn to it. You know, especially musicians, because they want to see what everybody else is doing. So it's sort of like a natural force in a way.
Well, you know, and this was kind of a boys' club. How did you break through? Like, what would you attribute to you breaking through and making a difference? Because, I mean, you really made it, it was groundbreaking.
I think there were a number of us there, not too many, and of course there weren't very many girls in the business then. But, you know, I think it was just an idea whose time had come, you know, and I felt determined. I felt that this was something that I had to do. You know, I had an obsession with it. And I was fortunate in that, you know, I had a wonderful partner, and we had a great time together. There was really good girls there, though there weren't that many. And, I had a stubborn streak. I perhaps still have it.
I like
and,
that.
Yeah.
That's what makes you who you are, though. I mean, you know, I love the edginess about you, and I think that's what has made you. That's part of your success story.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be able to stand up for yourself somehow. You know, it doesn't have to be in the biggest way, and it's surprising. You know, like when you do stand up for something that you really feel you must. It can be something that's very trivial, but it really gives you a great sense of yourself. And I think it's amazing. You just never know where it's going to lead.
That's right. No, that's right. And then your debut album came out in 76. And when I first heard Ripper to Shreds, I was like, wow, is there someone cool enough on the planet to write this? Because it wasn't just about the music. I mean, there's a lot of artists, it's just about the music or it's just about the lyrics. There was a great combination of both.
Yeah, well, it was definitely a tribute in a way, an homage to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground with that, you know, the feel of the music. Or we tried to make it like that. It wasn't quite exactly that. It was sort of a combination between punk and Lou Reed. And then the lyric was a sort of a parody, really, self-parody in some respects. And, you know, just sort of what... You know, what people get up to, you know, talking about one another or, you know, being bitchy.
Mm-hmm.
Get the bitch on.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, then came, you know, Plastic Letters, and came, you know, Parallel Lines, which reached number one in the UK, number six in the US, Heart of Glass, one way or another, you know, sold well over 20 million copies. And then in 79, you were on the cover of Rolling Stone. At what point did you say to yourself, wow, we've made it. We are on our way. This is it. What point of that era did you say that to yourself?
Well, I think, you know, once we started recording and it was, you know, I mean, nowadays you can record and it, very easily you can do it. But then, you know, you really had to have somebody interested in you via a label or management to make it possible to really record. And I think once we realized that, you know, somebody wanted to record what we were doing, that we were definitely, you know, in it, you know, in it to win it or whatever,
sure,
you know, however
sure
you want to put it.
Debbie Harry, the underground punk Harlow, is the star of Blondie. She looks the part. The members of Blondie have become important figures, if not heroes, to the dozens of new wave acts seeking widespread acceptance in this country, and the latest overnight sensations in a diverse late 70s rock boom that includes Elvis Costello, The Police, Cars, Dire Straits. The band shattered the new wave stigma of non-commercialism. Since Blondie's inception in 75, Debbie has been a fashion trendsetter as well as a sex symbol. I think you've carried that along through your entire career.
It's quite a mouthful you just...
Yeah, right?
That was quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I always sort of laugh. I'm a little bit mystified, but then I understand, you know, being a fashion trendsetter, I know women that are very chic and very fashionable, and I definitely am not quite that person, but I think what we did was we completely flipped. We flipped the coin and went in the opposite direction to what the current sort of trends were across the country, and therefore became remarkable. And the second thing that helped me with that was working with a wonderful designer named Steve Sprouse. And he is actually from, I believe he's from Indiana, but I know he spent a lot of time up around the lakes in the summertime.
Oh, cool.
So he's, you know, he's one of you guys.
Yeah, gotcha, gotcha. Midwesterners here. You know, and here's the thing, too. You know, all the success, and then you were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
Well, of course, you know, being a punk, I had to scoff at it. You know, I had to sort of say, oh, who wants that? You know, but then when it happened, I said, oh, wow, this is kind of great. You know, look at all these great people. And to be a part of that, you know, I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing, really.
And are you, and I'm going to come see you when you're here on Friday. And I have to ask you, you know, are you noticing a mix in your audiences? Is it baby boomers, young people, fans that just want to hear the hits? Like, what are you seeing in the crowds? I have a 15-year-old son who, when I was playing some of the music yesterday, telling him that I was going to talk to you today, and he knows every one of your songs. So, I mean, you're really crossing so many different generations these days.
Yeah. Well, I have always appreciated that and loved it. And I think it's one of the things about Blondie that, you know, has been consistent, honestly, since the very beginning. And our record company people back in the, you know, in the dark ages, they always remarked about that our, you know, our demographic was very, very spread. You know, there was no limitation to it. You know, we appealed to a lot of different age groups. So, you know, I can live with that. I think today it's changed in a way, you know, because of the availability of music. It's so easy to get and to, you know, anybody can listen to whatever they want. And, I think in radio it has changed too. I think that radio is not so, you know, prescribed, you know,
right.
It's not so, you know, your playlists are much bigger and can cover a lot of different eras. And it really makes sense, you know, it's our culture and it's what we listen to, it's what moves us, it's our daily lives, you know.
Well, Blondie is hitting the road again, and for more on new music,
tours, which I can't wait to see Debbie on stage again, visit blondie.net and debbieharry.com.
Always a pleasure talking to you, and what a thrill to spend a little time with you tonight.
Well, thank you so much for the your boost and all of your, you know, all of the attention to detail, and when you come to the show, please come and say hello.
I will do that.
Okay, bye, David.
All right, thanks again. Bye-bye. All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.
All right, 20 years after the success of her first memoir, the New York Times bestseller, The Truth Is, Melissa Etheridge, the Grammy and Oscar award-winning rocker and trailblazing icon, takes stock of the intervening years, recounting the euphoric triumphs and the life-altering tragedies of her life. In her book, Talking to My Angels, Melissa profoundly takes an honest look into her inner life as a woman, an artist, a mother, and a survivor. To me, well, she's simply an ass-kicker, and Grammy and Academy Award-winning Melissa Etheridge joins me tonight. I think ass-kicker covers a lot of who you are, doesn't it?
I appreciate that. That might be one of my favorite descriptions. Thank you.
Awesome. Absolutely. Well, you know what? You wrote a memoir a couple of decades ago. How was the writing process for you for this book so many years later? I mean, you're a different person, evolved in so many ways.
Oh, everything's so different now. It was just, you know, the spirit of where it was coming from. You know, the first book was like, oh, this happened to me, and then this happened to me, and then and this is how I, you know, wrote the songs, and this is what this meant. And now it's the difference of looking at your life when you're 30 and when you're 60. It's really, you know, your life, there's some deeper meanings, deeper stories, you know, to put in this book.
I know. I'm sure you look back at the first book when you were writing this one and said, well, okay, that's how I thought about it at that time. Now I see it a little bit differently, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the way, even the way we think of our parents, you know, and when you're 30, you're still kind of blaming your parents for a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're 60, then you have a little bit more empathy for your parents because you're a parent yourself. And you realize, oh, wow, my parents were just human beings doing the best they could.
Yeah, it is about, there's a couple things. It's about doing your best and seeing it that way. And also the intention, you know, like, did somebody on your journey intend to do that? Or was it just, it was what it was because they didn't know any better, right?
Yeah, so much of that. I mean, the time changes so much.
How do you find writing like these books different from other mediums, writing music, writing for the theater, which you've done? Like what's different about this memoir?
Well, I think of them as like containers, and a song is about a 3 or 4 minute container of a moment, you know, and I have that space to craft with words and rhythm and music something that entertains, that can delight or move someone. And then I think of the Broadway show that I'm doing right now. That's 2 hours that I have to tell story, to sing, to, you know, move people. And there's a bit more crafting going on there because you have more time and you really want to, you know, build the moment. And then a book is like, oh gosh, you've got it. There's so much space there.
Right.
And you still have to, there's still stuff you know, I could go on for days, you know, so it's just this sort of space you have to craft the story in.
Well, you talk about, and I love so many parts of this book, but this is about changing your choices, which you wrote, which I like very much. You talk about how those changes changed your life, and that's pretty much how you've lived your life, right?
Yeah, as things have come along to me, as things unfold, I've realized things don't happen to me. They unfold for me, and then it's my choice how I perceive them. Mm-hmm. And each one is a step. I think I've learned now in my 60s to not be knocked over by things anymore, to understand that this is what shapes and leads me to ask for different things and bring in things in my life. So those changes, all changes are good.
And so different, as you said earlier, from your younger self. It's just a different, it's a different viewpoint on life and what you can do with those choices. I love that you just said that you just, things weren't happening to her, they were happening and presented for you to make those other choices, right?
Yeah, and once I really came to that sort of belief about how my life is, it helps with the stress so much. I think nowadays, I mean, I started realizing after cancer that while stress is either I have a hold of it or it has a hold of me. And so to really know what stress does to me and my health and then to live and understand that I have choices in all of this.
Well, and you talk about those choices even early on in the book. You said when you were young, you know, you made the decision to use your mental energy only on creating music. What made you focus just on that at that time?
Well, it was the thought of, well, it was what was available to me at the time. You know, I started writing, and then that opened up the possibility of, I mean, I started playing music, and that opened the opportunity to write. And once I started writing, then the music became a vehicle for it. And I loved it. So I did it every day with this great love and excitement. And then it got better and better and better. And I just was like, ooh, let's see how far this can go. And I took it, you know, a large way. I went, yeah. You know, it went very large. And then, you know, just that, you realize it's not the end result that is the most satisfying, because the end result is like, oh, there it is, and then you kind of wake up the next day and move on. It's the journey. It's the fun in creating it and dreaming that dream and going, ooh, maybe I can write a book. Oh, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. And then you put it all there. Maybe I can do this on stage, and maybe I can present my life in an artistic way that can inspire and fill people up and you just go try to do it. And that's the fun part.
Well, I think it's no secret that when we talk about entertainers, you know, their best work comes out of life's challenges. So they say out of tragedy comes comedy, out of life's challenges comes great music. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the path, isn't it?
Yeah, I always say poor choices make great songs.
It's lovely. I love that. All right, I'm going to quote your book a little bit here because I love several things in here. The summer of 82, I drove west from Kansas to California on my own, determined to pull out all that came behind me, before behind me, the burdens of my childhood, my attempts to be a so-called normal girl and date guys, my brief stint in Boston, and to chart a new life for myself. I had $300 in my wallet as I set out for L.A., a yellow hatchback, a Stevie Wonder run-in. Determined to make it. And that just tells of such a cathartic time of not letting anything or anyone stand in your way, no matter what it took.
Yeah. And it wasn't like I had a lot of obstacles. Probably my biggest obstacle was my own fear. And, you know, once you just say, hey, I'm doing it no matter what, then you kind of, once you walk through a fear, you see that it dissipates and then you're on the road, you're doing it. And you just let it unfold in front of you every day. And, you know, it's easy for me to say now, but of course there were times I was like, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question. And speaking of writing this book, your love of reading wasn't books necessarily, it was poetry, which is a great path to write music.
Oh, completely. Oh, the poets. Sometimes someone will say, oh, you're a poet. I'm like, no, you don't understand. The poets do it without music. They do it with the rhythm of the words, the rhythm of syllables. They do it in a small, minute way and you know, take an emotion and just paint it just through those words. And I have great respect for poetry.
But at some point in your childhood, and again, you love poetry, you gave up reading. Like, so what was that? Why did you give up reading? It's a great story.
Well, that was the I'm mad at my mom, so I gave up reading, because my mother used to, my mother was kind of distant. She had a hard time, as a lot of women back in the 60s and 70s. She was very, very intelligent, and today would have had up some sort of computer something. She was a hidden figures type. She used to work for a big financial company in the computer room when computers were as big as rooms, and she brought computer programming to the Army and, of course, was paid half as much and mm-hmm. didn't get any of the credit. So she was a little cranky and frustrated, and I would come, she would come home at night and she would make dinner barely and then would sit and read just all night long. And it was like I couldn't talk to her. And so I was like, well, I don't ever want to do that, so I'm not going to read.
Stubborn
then,
kid.
You know, then I went out in my 20s and went, oh, wait a minute, there's a lot of really amazing things to read.
I love that. Well, let me ask you this. So, you know, did you read to your children when they were little? I would assume so.
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. I loved reading to my kids. And every now and then, my teenagers will still ask me, every now and then, if I can read something when they need that sort of kind of comfort and I'll read to them and it's just it's a beautiful thing to do for somebody is to read for them, and I read as long as I could to them every single night.
Let's say, what book most influenced you as your development as a musician? Do you remember like what book they were like, wow, this is really, was it poetry, was it a story about another musician?
Well, you know, one of the poets that really inspired me was Pablo Neruda. Mm-hmm. He was just beautiful, romantic poet. And I would say in my formulative songwriting years in my 20s, I would say it was J.D. Salinger and Vonnegut, Kurt Vonnegut. Those two were such interesting mm-hmm. ways of writing that were sort of outside the normal storytelling that it inspired me to write where people could still reach it, but just make them reach up a little. That was always my goal.
Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. We're talking to music icon Melissa Etheridge. You know, you mentioned in the memoir how an evening with a large amount of cannabis jump-started your spiritual awakening. How so? Explain that.
Well, I don't know if you've ever had a large amount of, if you've ever done the edibles and found yourself overdosed.
Mm-hmm.
I call it a heroic dose because there are people that do it on purpose and really go out there and explore their consciousness. And it was the first time I was out of my my own sort of solid three-dimensional consciousness and realized that there's much more in the world. There's much more of energy that we see, and it opened up the whole sort of esoteric landscape for me. And it's a journey that some people take and some people don't, and some people get there in many different ways. Mine was through plant medicine, through plant spirit, you know, through cannabis. I've since, you know, tried psilocybin and ayahuasca and a lot of different plant medicines. And for me, it's a wonderful way to find understanding, to find peace, to help with stress, to help just kind of cope with a lot of things.
Well, in a public life, and especially your public life, involves a lot of personal sacrifice and a complete loss of privacy. So how did that, becoming a more spiritual person, help ease the pain of all that?
Well, you start realizing that pain isn't caused by outside forces. Pain is the way that I'm looking at it. Pain is the way I'm thinking about it. And you start looking at things and going, well, you know what, this is there again for me, and it's not happening to me.
Well, plus there's got to be a lot of the spiritual nature of who you are probably helped you write this book. There's a lot of healing that's involved when you do something like that. So having that spiritual journey and experiencing that and living that every day only has to help, right?
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. I wanted to maybe be an example or an inspiration to people who are maybe searching for something like that.
Here's an example, as I quote what you wrote in the book: when I see how much my own thoughts and emotions create my reality, create what's in front of me, there's real power in that, really speaks about who you are. And, you know, you've had to deal with some life issues and recovering mm-hmm. from a great loss in your life, right?
Yeah, the sadness that you can feel as a parent. I lost my son when he was 21 about 3 years ago. to an opioid addiction, and that really was the challenge, because I had sort of been walking this path of, okay, I'm creating my reality, you know, the better it gets, the more joy, you know, all those things I was sort of walking, and yet I would see my son suffering, and it was quite a challenge. And when he finally overdosed, when he finally passed, you know, it got really dark there, and it really challenged me to either believe this or not. You know, am I going to let this be the thing that just destroys me and covers me up, and I can't show my face anymore because I'm going to take on the guilt and shame of, you know, my son and what could I have done for him and those sort of things? Or am I going to say, wow, you know, opioids are a big problem, and my son made his choices, and I did the best I could, and he's in a place of no pain now, and I do believe life is eternal. I do believe our life source is eternal, and we are all connected, and I find great comfort in that.
Melissa Etheridge, her book is Talking to My Angels. Her Broadway play is My Window. You know, another great read, Melissa. Great insight into your journey, and honestly, happy you shared it again with all the world.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, news is next here on 720 WGN.
Next is the founder, songwriter, and guitarist of pop rock group The Bangles, Vicki Peterson, who founded The Bangles along with sister Debbie and Susanna Hoffs. One of the greatest all-female bands is lauded for their inventive incorporation of 60s folk rock, sunny Southern California harmonies, and Beatles, Byrds, Beach Boys, Big Star, Godhead into the sound all its own. Theirs is a rags-to-riches story from the band's beginnings in L.A.'s Paisley Underground scene through their reign as chart-topping, record-breaking, smart-pop princesses of the 80s through the 1989 breakup, 1999 reunion, and current position as rock legends, rocking, recording, and touring for a whole new generation of fans. And joining us to share that journey is Vicki Peterson. Welcome in, Vicki.
Hey, nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, I always like to share with our listeners the origins on how a group comes together. And it was sometime in late 1980 that you and your sister Debbie placed an ad looking for musicians, right?
Yes, actually, it's a little convoluted, but our roommate, who was also our just recently fired lead guitarist, was the one who actually placed the ad. So Susanna called an ad that she saw that had been placed by our guitar player, who still lived with Debbie and me, and I picked up the phone. So,
so that was happenstance, pretty much.
It kind of was. It was one of those meant to be moments, and of course, I did the diligent thing, and I did pass along the message to our roommate. But it turns out that Susanna and Lynn didn't really click, and Susanna and I had definitely clicked on the phone, so I called her right back and said, so, let's meet up.
That's very cool. And you were in a band. I mean, you and your sister were in a band yourself. It was called Those Girls at the time, right?
Yes. We had been playing since high school, and Debbie was, I think, 15 when she got her first drum kit, and I was 16, 17, and we'd been playing for a couple of years in the clubs in Los Angeles, and just at that point, the band had sort of whittled down to just Debbie and me, so we're sort of looking for something new, and we found Susanna, and that started a new trajectory for us.
Very cool, very cool. Now, you briefly called yourselves, I think it was the Colors, then it was the Supersonic Bangs, then it was just the Bangs. Where did the Bangs come from?
Well, both the Supersonic Bangs and the Bangs both came from a mid-60s edition of Esquire magazine that Susanna found in her parents' home, and we were just drooling over it because we was a bit of freaks about anything about the 60s.
Yeah.
And it was an article on hairstyles, and they were just sort of doing a bit of a satire on the wacky hairdos of the day. Nothing like the 80s, of course.
No. Not at all.
And there was one called the Supersonic Bangs, and we thought, that's it, that's our name. And we called Debbie, she was at work, and we said, Debbie, Supersonic Bangs. And she went, it's a little long, it sounds like Teardrop Explodes. And said, okay, how about the Bangs? And she said, love it. So we were the Bangs.
Yeah, you were the Bangs. And, you know, at that time, okay, that you were forming the group, you know, what was the groups or the performers that were inspiring you at the time, like to perform? Was it really based on the 60s? Were there some 70s in there?
60s and 70s. I mean, it's everything from, you know, of course, Beatles were the touchstone and, sure. and the Rolling Stones, and loved the, I personally just loved all the vocal harmony groups, the Mamas and Papas, the, you know, the Beach Boys, the Cowsills, you know.
Yeah.
And then we were also influenced by the sort of, you know, do-it-yourself punk movement, you know, and Susanna really loved Talking Heads, and, you know, I loved Television and Blondie, and, you know, so that was very inspiring, the Ramones, to kind of the idea of, you know, anyone can do this. So it was sort of, it was a lovely sort of gumbo of...
Yeah, it is. It's a really cool mix of styles, yeah. Now, your first single was released almost, you know, 1 year to the date that you all met. It was Getting Out of Hand, and that was on your own record label, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Down Kitty Records. Again, it's a do-it-yourself world even then, and as much as it is now.
Right.
And we, you know, we sort of pooled our day job money and went into a little studio in Venice and recorded that. It took about, I don't know, a few hours. And, you know, did the whole thing, you know, Xeroxed the covers ourselves and put them in little plastic sleeves and brought them around to record stores.
Well, it's really like that now. I mean, you really got to promote yourself and figure out a way to get your music out there, especially the way the music industry has turned in the last decade or so. But back then, you know, that was a pretty cool and pretty bold move to get your record out there. I mean, if you couldn't find a label or if you didn't even want to go that route and deal with the BS, you went out and did it on your own.
Absolutely. And that's what a lot of our friends were doing. That's how we saw the best way clear to get our music out. You know, you put flyers on telephone poles, you did it yourself. It was just the technology was a little more primitive.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, we were more interested in doing that than trying to ensnare the big label. As a matter of fact, we were reluctant prey for, you know, the labels that did come around, and finally the two gentlemen from Columbia Records were persistent enough, and they were the ones who wanted us the most.
Yeah, and proved it to you. Yeah. Well, a couple years later, you changed your names to the Bangles. Why the change?
Well, we had recorded an EP. We were just about ready to put it out. We actually had the artwork done and everything, and we were approached by a band, I believe they're from New Jersey, called The Bangs, an all-boy band, by the way. And they had been performing under that name for a while, and you know, we were very disappointed because we had been under the assumption that once you put out a record, you kind of secured the identity for yourself, but that's not necessarily true.
And where are they now? And where are the Bangs now? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. I don't know. Google them.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, your first EP came out in 82, and this is pretty cool because American Bandstand was still pretty prevalent at that time with Dick Clark. And, you know, in 83, you made your first appearance and did an interview with Dick Clark. How cool was that?
Yeah, that was kind of overwhelming.
It's surreal, I would think.
He could not have been more charming and gracious. And he just, you know, it seemed to me like at that point he was still... you know, somebody who was bringing new music and fresh sounds to, you know, to the mass public. It was amazing, actually.
I've got a clip from the interview I'm going to play. Let's take a quick listen.
has your music changed?
I think it's always changing. You know, it's always growing and changing. And we're just, we're happy with what we're doing. We're having a good time on stage across America. We're on tour.
Do you have a master plan of where you'll be a few years from now?
I think we'll be doing what we're doing now. We're keeping our sense of humor and having a lot of fun. Yeah.
The nice thing about it is you have been... This is terrifically complimentary. Critics have said they are Beatlesque. Ooh. They have magnificent four-part harmonies. I mean, they go on and on. It's just good stuff.
All right. That was pretty cool. Now, in 1984, you mentioned you met these gentlemen from CBS Records from Columbia. You were touring with Cyndi Lauper, and you caught the eye of Prince. And tell me about the story about, you know, Different Light in the album, but Manic Monday. Tell me about the story about Manic Monday.
Well, it was very interesting. Prince had sort of, I think he had seen our video for Hero Take the Fall off the first Columbia record, and had sort of been taken an interest in the group, and possibly our diminutive singer, Susanna. And he sent us a couple of songs, actually, on cassette tape.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And, you know, we thought Manic Monday would be a really good fit for us. It felt very, again, kind of 60s-ish in certain ways. It had this, you know, harpsichord riff, and there was something a little psychedelic about it in certain ways.
Great rhythm.
Yeah, a great feel to it. And then also the lyrics were very relatable to everybody on the planet, you know. And so who hasn't had that day start? And we just, you know, we loved it. It felt like a song that we could have written that it's, you know, it fit well. And so he, you know, and he was saying, oh, you know, and you can just go ahead and sing over the tracks, you know, just use these tracks. And we said, oh, thank you, but we'll
support it.
But thank you so much.
But at the time, people didn't know that Prince was behind that song, I don't believe, right?
He was doing a movie at the time, and his character was called Christopher, and he was determined to not use Prince, but to credit the song to Christopher.
Very cool.
There you go.
That's a pretty cool story. That's a great story.
It's that guy.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, that was, you know, and that hit number two on the Billboard charts in 86 off the album Different Light, and there was Walk Like an Egyptian, She Knew What She Wants. Later was Eternal Flame from the 88 album Everything, and the rest is history. I mean, you guys really came out of the box.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting.
Now, you play quite a few instruments. Besides vocals, you play guitar, the mandolin, the bass guitar, the piano, the ukulele. Did you take lessons as a kid? Or are you self-taught? I mean, that's a wide variety of instruments there.
Yeah, I don't play piano in public too often.
Okay.
My husband will do that. It's other than a few guitar lessons when I was 9, and I think I took about 4 piano lessons when I was 12. I'm a very poorly self-taught musician. Put it that way. I'm a hack, but a happy hack.
Okay, all right. All right. Now, there was about a decade in there that the Bangles broke up and you eventually drifted back together. What brought you all back together? What made you all say, yeah, let's do this again?
It was a sort of slow crawl back because, you know, we were all doing different things in our lives. I was in New Orleans playing with the Continental Drifters, very happy musically with that world. And it was an opportunity. There was a couple of things that popped up because over the years, several things had been brought my way, different reunion sort of tours or 80 packages. And, you know, I just really wasn't interested in doing a nostalgia thing. And I talked to Suzanne on the phone a few times and finally said, look, the only thing that I would be interested in if we're going to do something like this is if we were going to write new material and you know, and be a viable band. I'm not interested in just going back and playing, you know, old songs.
Yeah, and plus it was only 10 years after that. I mean, that's not all of a sudden, you know, another 20, 30 years of reunion tours. It was time for some fresh music, absolutely.
Yeah, it really was. And it was the only thing that made sense to me at the time and to this day, actually, still. So we actually did get together. We wrote a song. There was an opportunity to get a song in. Susanna's husband is Jay Roach, and he did all the Austin Power films.
Right. You were on the soundtrack.
Party scene.
Yeah,
and that's really one of the things that was an opportunity to get together in the studio. And I contacted Michael Steele, our bass player, to, you know, make sure that she was interested and involved, and she was. And so it was really the four of us for the first time, you know, in 10 years got together in a studio, which was pretty wonderful, actually. It was like kind of freakishly easy.
Yeah, that's cool. When was the first time you played here? Where'd you play? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't remember the first place. God, I remember doing some cool shopping. There were some really cool record stores.
There are great record stores. In fact, I come from the record industry, and I met all of you backstage once back, I think it may have been 89, in Minneapolis when I was working for the Musicland group up then. But here there was all kinds of, you know, Rolling Stone records and rock records downtown Chicago. And this was the mecca. I miss record stores, I got to tell you.
I remember specifically just doing some serious record shop in Chicago in the early days. It was a very cool scene.
Vicki Peterson of The Bangles. For more, visit thebangles.com. MTV Music Television was launched, changing the entire face of the music industry and pop culture. The first music video to air was The Buggles, Video Killed the Radio Star, introducing an entirely new concept of television, hosted by the first group of MTV video jockeys, also known as VJs. That's Mark Goodman, Martha Quinn, Alan Hunter, JJ Jackson, and our guest, Nina Blackwood. Hi, Nina.
Hi,
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I am excellent. And I'll tell you, I mean that when I say that, that as I was watching some clips on YouTube of you on the first days of MTV, but you are really what embodied MTV at a time where we were all curious and all watching it.
It's great. Thank you.
But I'll tell you something. When I hear your voice, you are perpetually 20-something because you and the original VJs are so indicative of that time. And right when you started there, I think I was in the midst of high school. And really, when you wanted to listen to music, you listened to the radio. All of a sudden, it became the cool place to go discover music was MTV.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is what I... I mean, some people could say... you know, it is a double-edged sword because, you know, the naysayers of it, they said, well, it destroyed your image of the song. And, you know, I understand that, and depending on the video, it might have, but it just opened up this whole new world of creativity where directors, before we went on the air, you and I were talking about the advertising community. And here there were directors and producers, art directors, scenery people who were, a lot of them, doing commercials, television commercials. But as you well know, that's very restrictive. You have to do what the client wants you to do.
There was music programs like the Midnight Special and some of these other
things.
And you would see people in concert, but you never had... visuals to the story, and other people try to do stuff with Cube and pop clips and radio with pictures and stuff, but it never did anything. Those first days with Martha Quinn and Alan Hunter, Mark Goodman, J.J. Jackson at the helm, what did they tell you to do? Like, what did they say to you that first day? How were you bumping in music videos? Like, what was the structure at the time?
Well, actually, Mark and I were hired first. So we had a full, and Meg Griffin, who ended up being, she left. She didn't enjoy it. She's a real radio person. So then Martha and Alan came in. JJ came in right after us, and Martha was the last one hired, and Alan in between. So virtually Mark and I had the full month that they were experimenting before we even hit the air. And then the other ones had like either 3 or 2 weeks respectively. And so we were experimenting. The cameramen were getting their basically dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
So we had already been rehearsing before we did that first day. And in the beginning days, since it has never been done before, there was no outline to follow. So it was kind of...
you created it,
you know,
kind of as you went.
Flying by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, so there was a lot of experimentation and a lot of very free-for-all. In fact, you could see some of the early days, those first 2 years were actually the most fun, I think, for all of us because, you know, they would start us out scripted, and then there would be no script at all, and then there would be a kind of bullet points, you know, like a culmination, mm-hmm.
Sure.
So it would be, you know, what we had to cover, but then we would talk, you know, do our own little spiel, and all sorts of crazy things in the early days. That's when it was just so much fun. When I remember, I it sounds like a plug, but I'm not saying it so much as a plug. I'm a big reader, but we did put out a book if people want to read about our days, an oral history. It's called VJ, the story of MTV's first wave, and it's all about those days. You know, so
I have the book. It's a great read.
Yeah, I mean, if people like to read like I do, you know, they'd really. And even if they don't like to read, it's fun. It's a fun book. But that really goes in depth as to what was happening behind the scenes.
Very cool. Original MTV VJ Nina Blackwood. Now that wraps up our radio special, The Women of Rock. If you missed any of the program, visit WGNradio.com to hear it all. All right, that is it for us. Top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom are next, right here on 720 WGN.